This week in Retronauts, we race the beam. Hi, everyone. Welcome to this episode of Retronauts. I haven't actually figured out when this is going live, so I don't know the number, but it's in the 500s. And this week is a very self-indulgent episode as I desperately promote my employment and my continued employment prospects. Yes, this week we are talking about Atari, but in the context of a book that I helped edit and design for limited run games. So those of you who feel that there is no journalistic integrity left in Retronauts, you are correct, and I don't care, because we have with us the author of Atari Archive Volume 1, Kevin Bunch, to talk about the origins of the Atari system and also the process of putting together a book about the early days of Atari. So Kevin, I've just introduced you, but please introduce yourself again, just for the redundancy.
Hi, I'm Kevin Bunch. I'm the author of Atari Archive, and I do the YouTube series of the same name, and have been for several years now.
And also with us here is another person who was indispensable and integral to the creation of this book.
The fun is back. Oh, yes, sirree. It's me.
That is anachronistic, sir. Yes. That is not... This is a book about 1977 and 78.
Yeah.
And you are deep diving into 1987.
Yeah,
you're
that's true.
A decade out of sync.
I am completely out of sync. And that's probably a terrible precedent being set for the rest of the episode. I'm Jared Petty, also of Limited Run Games. Very happy to have been a small part of this project and happy to be here with you.
I mean, you edited the whole book, so that's not a small part. That's an important part of the process.
It's a chunky book.
It's a beefy boy. Yeah. This is a large lad. It's, like 288 pages of Atari content. And, a fair number of those pages are full page photographs. But there's a lot of text in here because Kevin did a lot of research about it. And I've been kind of weird about like talking about the books that I produce on Retronauts, because I feel like it's two separate streams of continuity. And is it wrong to promote things that I do in my day job on the podcast? Is it a conflict of interest? I guess. But also it's super germane to this podcast subject of talking about video game history, preserving video game history, getting perspectives and facts about video game history. So, yeah, so I feel this episode had to happen because the three of us here in this room, primarily Kevin, but, you know, all of us, created this book about Atari's origins in the console gaming space. This jumps, you know, through their Sigigy years and, you know, the early arcade years, and directly to the Atari 2600's development, creation, etc. But it is by far the most comprehensive and detailed look at not only the early days of the 2600, my God, there's so many numbers. Should not have had that second Pinot Grigio.
I mean, you did hit the right numbers. There is a 7800. There is a 2800.
Yes. You just scramble them up. No, the early days of the 2600, but also just the context of the video games business, so to speak, as it existed at the time, which was not really that much of a business. But Kevin, you did a great job of just like laying it all out there and really, I think, showing what was unique about the 2600 and its library compared to the competition. And, you know, I think when you read through this book and you read stuff about like the MP1000 and the Odyssey, like you get a really great understanding of why the 2600 succeeded. So yeah. let's talk about this book. Like, I don't know, like as the author looking at this completed book, what are your thoughts? And you know, how did this even happen?
It is still deeply surreal that I have a book, you know, at this, my 39th year of, you know, existing, and what, my 15th year of writing stuff professionally.
It took you that long, my God.
Yeah, I don't know. I don't know what I was
doing. That's what zines were for, man.
I mean, I did do some writing for zines in the 2000s. I wrote for the Digital Press fanzine for a while there.
Okay.
And actually, one of my first writing credits was on their 2004 Video Game Collector's Guide, their advanced one.
Digital Press Guide, yeah.
Yep, for like 16-bit stuff. I did the Memorex Vis section. But yeah, for this took a fair bit. I'll probably just repeat some stuff from our Q&A that we did earlier today.
That's fine, because the people listening to this podcast...
mostly weren't there.
Were not there. Maybe there were like three people listening to this podcast who were there, but five, I guess? Okay, five.
And if you were there,
I apologize to the five of you who were at the Q&A.
Yeah.
Thank you for
this
coming.
This is old material for you, but for the thousands, tens of thousands of other people listening to this episode, not having been at the Q&A about the book, this is all fresh and new. So, Kevin, rehash away.
Yeah, sure. So, I'm a journalist by trade originally. I went to school for that. I worked at several newspapers full-time and freelance. But with video game writing, there was the fanzines. And then in 2008, or thereabouts, Jen Frank, who, you know, formerly worked at 1UP and, you know, made some Retronauts appearances at that time frame.
Some very memorable Retronauts appearances. Go check out archive.org and look up Retronauts, and you can hear some great episodes with Jen on them.
Mm-hmm. Especially about Atari, because she is also a giant Atari nerd.
Yep.
So anyway, she had a website, infinitelives.net, which you can find on the Wayback Machine if you really want to listen. To check it out, and she asked me if I would write some retrospectives for it, you know, giving me Jeremy's retrospectives he had been doing for 1UP.com and on his own website as like examples. It's like, yeah, it's the kind of thing I think you'd be really good at like doing yourself. So I wrote a few of those. You know, two of us liked Atari stuff, so that was a regular topic, was Atari era. I know I did a Casey Crazy Chase, the sequel to Casey Munchkin, and that one actually got picked up by Kotaku.
Nice.
Yeah, so that's somewhere on
there.
That
wasn't an Atari game, though.
That was not, but it's a great game. I also wrote one on Mountain King, which was on the 2600 and is a really good version of it. Not in this book, but still, great game. And Burger Time, that was the other one that's jumping to mind. But anyway... flash forward a couple of years, 1UP.com still existed at the time, and Jeremy was still working there at the time. And
man, that was a long-ass time ago.
Yeah.
All those halcyon days.
Uh-huh. And they were doing theme weeks at the time, I remember, and they had a theme week about the Atari 2600 because it had just turned 25 or something, 35, I don't remember. It's like 2012. Submitted a pitch for an article for it about, you know, people who collect Atari 2600 games, and I wrote that up. It was pretty fun to put together. He really liked it, posted it online, and I thought, you know, that was a lot of fun. I would like to write about video games more. I can't really do that at my day job working at a newspaper where I'm covering, you know, city council meetings and science news and all sorts of fun stuff. So maybe I'll do that on the side. And at that point, I hadn't quite figured out how I wanted to do that. Flash forward a couple more years, I discovered Crontendo, and I discovered, Jeremy Parrish was doing his Game Boy project at the time. And I thought, that's an approach I could use. I could go through the library of the 2600 in this sort of a similar fashion and sort of dig into the history of each of these games. The problem was, of course, at the time, I didn't know when any of these games came out. No one else on the internet really did. So that took another 3 years to hash out a release list just by going off of whatever sources I could find. And some of those do appear in this book. There's a little appendix section where I mark out where...
Oh, no, you have an amazing bibliography. I am so lazy. When I put my books together, it's just like a random mishmash of stuff that I've heard, and then I just like look at it in public sources, and I'll mention it, you know, in the article or the video. like, hey, here's a thing. But you actually have, you know, you've been respectable and scholarly about things.
Well, it's wonderful. Bad. It's going to make future researchers have a lot easier time finding.
I'm not doing much good for the community, but that's okay because you are. You did great research here, and you documented it all.
And it was such a pain to put that bibliography together.
I bet that part of the book sucks always. Yep.
But yeah, so I started doing these videos in 2017 for Atari Archive, which is my YouTube channel, going game by game. And then after so many years of this, I thought, well, I've got a lot more resources now. I'm kind of interested in revisiting some of these early videos and fleshing them out more, but I don't want to make another video because that's a lot more effort than I have time to deal with when I have so many new games to deal with, relatively speaking. So I thought, well, okay, I can put up stuff on this website that nobody visits because nobody goes to personal websites anymore. I think the one I have for Atari Archive gets maybe like 20 hits a month tops.
One a day.
Most of them are me looking up stuff for my own video projects.
Well, there you go.
Because that's where I have all sorts of release date information that I've dug up, posted. And then I thought, well, I could do a book, and I was sort of playing around with the idea of self-publishing something that would basically just be, you know, like these write-ups I'd been doing and into a cheap little ebook thing. And that was about the same time you approached me for this Press Run Games thing and asking if I'd be interested in putting together a book. And I already had this in mind. I'm like, let's do this. Let's do Atari Archive Volume 1. And we hammered out what years it would cover because I wanted to, you know, give some value for the money there. So we cover 77 and 78, so that's 20 games.
And the fact that you're calling it Volume 1 is very exciting to me because I really enjoyed working on this book and doing the layouts and everything. And, you know, the photography, just a chance to visit all these games that really are from before I had access to home video games. So it's all kind of new to me. Mm-hmm. And I'm excited about doing a Volume 2 with you.
Yeah.
Get on that.
I got to read this book a couple of times in prepping this, and it's easily... I've read a lot of books about Atari. This is easily my favorite. and a lot of that comes down to something you talked about earlier in the QA. You know, we're talking about the video game basketball.
Yeah.
And you pointed out, you know, that you and I both enjoy that game. You pointed out that at the time, in 1978, when someone's designing basketball, there isn't really a lot of source material to go to. You know, there hasn't been basketball in video games before. Mm-hmm. And so you have different companies, not just Atari, but different companies that we now think of as defunct, but that then were active, vibrant developers that were competing and coming up with their own original ideas. And everybody was trying to simulate a sport, but they came at such different angles. Things that felt like Pong to super primitive, side-scrolling, inaccurate, strange takes with players that looked like players, but that didn't actually feel fun, all the way up to almost, you know, a sort of a forced false depth approach. Someone inventing that for a mm-hmm. one-on-one sport where the AI scales to how far the player is behind, and all of these takes arriving at almost exactly the same time from different teams at different companies as they all try to figure out this medium. That's really exciting. No other video game histories I've read touch on that reality because that's unique to this period in this story. And Kevin, I really think you just say some bold, energetic things that are going to excite people that care about history. Even folks that read a lot of history books about games are going to be startled how little they know about this. And I think that's really cool.
Another great thing about this book is that you've included so much direct research material in here, you know, scans of these old trade magazines that I've never heard before. You actually took the time to get permission to do that. God bless you. Mm-hmm. And you did original interviews with people. You also found interviews with people who were, you know, pivotal to this era online and cited those sources. And it's just, it's a really just a comprehensive picture of what video games were in 1977, which was not much, but there was a lot of thought and energy being put into how can we make money making little blips move around on a television screen. And yeah, just the different forms that took is really interesting. And yeah, like seeing the different interpretations of things like just simple math games and how every company did their own take on that or on basketball mm-hmm. is really great. And you do a good job of, you know, providing some context for other systems in kind of these standalone chapters, but also within each game's entry, you know, as part of a 2600 library, you do an excellent job of saying, well, this is the thing that existed on 2600. Here's the other stuff. Like, it's really interwoven here. So it's not just a book about the 2600, but about really home video games and their origins. Mm. And that is such a great, just, you know, for anyone who cares about video game history and the growth and birth of this medium, this is indispensable. And I'm not just saying this because, you know, I worked on it and published it. Like, I'm kind of in awe of what you've put together here. It's a really great document.
Well, I'm glad you're here to represent integrity. I'm here for the money, definitely, right now.
Yes, I know you, Jared. You're just so mercenary.
I am, totally. I just go to the highest bidder. Another thing that I really loved about reading this, that we complain constantly about modern video games, about how derivative they are, about how unoriginal games are, about how every game is just the game. Man, it's always been that way, or worse. I mean, everybody had to have their... Turns out everybody had to have their shootout game. Everybody had to have their math game. Everybody had to have their space game. And it's amazing how, while these play radically differently, how similar the concepts are and the fact they're all coming out at the same time. Mm-hmm. And it really is kind of the more things change, the more the same reality. I think there's this kind of mythic idea that once video games were a magical, experimental, creative land where everything was new and fresh. And there are a lot of new, fresh things here. It's just there's four versions of all of those new, fresh things.
Right.
And that's neat. We're Jeremy and I are kind of popping on the praise here, man. What I'd really like to hear from you is, you worked really hard for a really long time to make this. What shook or surprised you when you were digging through and finding all this material, when you were learning all these stories? What really jumped out at you, just like, wow, I hadn't thought about it that way before?
Yeah, thank you. Contextualizing the history of the console was like really important to me because it's so old. And these games, especially in the 77-78 period, are just so early and relatively primitive for the Atari library and what it would get later on. To answer your question, I feel like Combat, like the first game made for the system, was the one that I found it particularly fascinating to write about, because if you looked up online, you know, resources for the game's development, you'd find like an interview with Joe DeCure, who helped design the final 2600 hardware, and like he helped work on an early version of this game that then got passed along to someone else who finished it out. And I talked to literally everyone involved in the creation of Combat, which was more than just Joe DeCure and this other guy. There was two other people on top of that. So I was able to track down and interview Larry Wagner, who at that point had not done any interviews about his time at Atari. Mine was like the second he had done in a week, and he had like something else lined up with the History Channel, which also gets mentioned in here. But he explained the part of it that he worked on, and he also had all of his documentation still. He had donated the originals to Stanford, but he still had, you know, scanned them all for himself. So he sent me the scans, and we were able to go through them together. And I actually included my interview with Larry at the back of this book, because he's really interested in getting his own story of the his time at Atari out there, just because it hadn't been before. So if you want to read about that, that's in here too, as well as copies of all those scan pages. He gave me permission on that. But germane to combat, he one of his documents mentioned the different revisions of combat, because it was being developed the same time as the Atari hardware was being finalized. So that was sort of a chicken and egg sort of situation. And the very first revision that he had on his list mentioned that it came from Cyan Engineering, and it had a tank game. It had the jet fighter game, which is that's on the retail cart. It also had a racing game and a version of Pong. And I was really interested in this, so I asked him about it, and he's like, "Oh yeah, that's just what they gave me." And we cut the racing game and Pong because they didn't fit on the next hardware revision on the cart. So, where did those come from? I checked with the guys who worked on the Atari hardware design, Steve Mayer and Ron Milner, and they're like, "Oh yeah, we put together that original version of this game, that very primitive demo, just to prove that this stuff would work on the hardware we designed." And then we sent it along with Joe DeCure to Atari once we'd finished. Cyan Engineering, I should specify, was a company that Atari had bought out and was sort of like their R&D skunk works house. They worked on this, they worked on a few other projects in the 70s and a whole bunch of other things after the 2600. But so I was able to sort of assemble the whole early history of combat's creation for this book, as well as try and put it in place of time, because it is a port of a couple of different Atari games, Jet Fighter and Tank. And it also had other versions of that game for other platforms, which I make note of, and what they did well and what they didn't do well compared to Atari's. And it's interesting to me, less to make a judgment call like, oh, this game's not great, this game kind of it's not that fun in 2023. For me, it's more interesting to consider how were these games looked at the time, and what sort of impact did they make, both internally and on the broader market? And I hope I did a good enough job on all of these, because some of these, basic math, it's basic math. It's a math game. And I took this as an opportunity to delve into why did all these companies make math games?
There's not too much to say about basic math, but I was, with that one especially, I was really impressed by just how much detail you went into on math offerings from other companies and why those existed.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and there is basic math, but there's also things like flag capture, where you're just like, oh, these really early games, flag capture, if you plug one into a 2600 and turn it on today, you'll turn it right back off. It's a bunch of squares on a screen. But you do a great job of being like, no, this is compelling. And original.
Yeah.
This wasn't one that wasn't cloned all to death. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, it's a little bit like the Bokosko Wars of its day.
Yeah, so Flag Capture was made by Jim Huether. I think it was his first game at the company. And he wanted to make a port of Stratego, the board game. That was clearly not happening on the 2600 hardware in 2 kilobytes of cartridge space. So he sort of trimmed it down. It's like, okay, Stratego is about checking squares for a flag, and I'm going to make a game where you're checking squares for a flag against another player. And these squares can sometimes have a bomb that'll send you back to your starting point. I can make game types that'll adjust how your scoring works. Sometimes the flag will move, and you'll have to just sort of predict where it's going. And it was one of those games he described in an old interview. I didn't get to talk to Huether myself. But he described it as a game that you either got and really, really liked, or a game that you just bounced off of hard. And I really liked it, and I think that came through in how I wrote about it. Because it's actually a really interesting game, and it is a lot of fun with two players. I roped in a few different friends of mine to do all the two-player content on this thing, and they weren't through... Well, dependent on the game. Some of them they weren't thrilled about. Some of them they really enjoyed.
What were some of the other popular two-player games during your research?
Home Run, the baseball game. It's a very stripped down baseball game, but we had fun with it. Basketball, great game. Everyone loves it. Slot Racers, kind of a weird one. It's a weird one regardless, but
Was that the first Atari racing game on the system?
So that would be a tie between Indy 500 and Street Racer.
Okay.
But Indy 500 is the first, like, versus.
So they did, like, Indy racing and street racing, and then we're like, let's do toy cars also.
That name on that one is so goofy, and I get into it in the book, too, because this was Warren Robinette's first game, and his initial idea was that it would be, like, a road rage kind of game, where you'd all be driving cars around with rocket launchers on the hoods, and you're shooting at each other.
Twisted Metal 1977.
Yeah, because you're mad at each other, and there'd be cop cars and such. He couldn't fit the cop cars in, and for whatever reason, Atari's marketing changed the name to Slot Racers from, you know, a game about shooting each other in a maze.
Okay.
I haven't figured out who at Atari came up with that decision. No, maybe a future revision of this book will have that if I ever land that, but...
In a world with more ROM space, they might have accidentally invented GTA. Look
right.
At that.
They
could... Or Interstate 76.
Oh.
Or 78 or whatever it's called.
Ooh, yeah, 76. Oh, I love that game.
It's been timely.
Yeah, right? Exactly.
I'm going to take a moment to embarrass my boss.
Josh?
No, you.
I'm not your boss. I'm just your fellow press run writer.
All right. Well, I'm going to take a moment to embarrass my fellow press run writer. Another thing I really like about this book is that in addition to just very solid research and good quality of writing, there's a lot of original photography. Jeremy puts a ton of work into taking good pictures, and he's trained himself over the years to take marvelous close-ups, and the amount of time he puts into it's really impressive. But it's a really good looking book. There's original photography of the game boxes, the cartridges, a lot of the hardware, and it's very nicely done. Again, I read a lot of video game books, and none of this is just cheaply ripped from somewhere, you know, low res. This is all original.
Yeah, I'm a big fan
work.
Of not just downloading random sized JPEGs of varying quality and approach from Google Images, but actually like tracking down original games. And Kevin had most of these games already. Mm-hmm. So I happened to be up near where he lives last summer for my nephew's graduation. I was like, well, I'm like 30 minutes from you. I should just come over and photograph your collection. And then everything that didn't show up in the book, you know, like wasn't already in his collection and needed to be in the book, we just acquired and photographed. And, you know, initially the idea, I think, was just to get a version of each game. But mm-hmm. as the book evolved, I think we both kind of agreed, like, to really make this properly comprehensive, we needed to get the Atari and Telegames versions of all the games that had alternate versions, which I think at this point was all of them, right?
Yes.
And then there's a few alternate releases, like Basic Math became fun with numbers, right. And there's one other that also had a third.
Concentration.
Yes, that's the one. So, you know, we were able to rely on some people that we know, like Chris Rendazzo, who works with Castlemania Games, I believe. No, Stone Age Gamer. Mm. Lent us the extremely rare revision of Fun with Numbers, and we were able to photograph that. So it was a community effort for sure. But, you know, as we worked on this, I think the opportunity kind of, we became aware of this was an opportunity to really go comprehensive with this material and just create kind of the definitive document about this era of Atari. And that means just taking photos of all the stuff we can find so you can look at the back of the boxes, some mm-hmm. of which have descriptions of the games and some of which just have little grids saying, here's what's in the game.
Yep. It's probably the prettiest photo of an RCA Studio 2 that exists.
Yep.
Where is that? What page is that?
87.
87. All right. Turning your hymnal to page 87. That's a pretty nice picture. And then your compadre, collaborator who let us photograph TV Bingo, the game that only like three copies exist of.
Yeah, I have a collector buddy who lives in the area, and he was also interested in contributing to the book, so he brought a few items for the studio too that there was no way I was ever going to purchase.
Yeah, and like realistically, like from an organizational standpoint, it doesn't necessarily make sense for this stuff to be in here, but this material is so rare and of such high quality that I, as the editor, I just said, I've got to put this in there.
Got to like, take the opportunity.
Why not? Just so high-resolution photography of a game from 1976 that only, you know, only exists in, like, enough copies that you can count on one hand. Like, we've got to get that in there.
I believe that my Heavy Sixer and CX-10s ended up in here somewhere, didn't
yeah,
they?
Yeah, I believe they are on the Collector's Edition.
Ah, that's right. That's the Collector's Edition. Yeah. Once I wondered about that.
Yeah, we photographed my Light Sixer, which ironically was not used for any of the video capture in this book. I used my grandmother's old 2600 Junior that has a stellar picture out.
Nice.
Yeah.
Yeah, but you can definitely tell these are direct captures, not from an emulator. Like, there's ghosting and some fuzziness. They just look real. Like, this is... This is what I remember Atari games looking like.
Yeah.
Not super crisp, and, you know, they also don't have the weird proportion issues that you get sometimes when you look up 2600 footage on YouTube where people don't understand that, hey, this needs to be 4x3.
Yeah.
So they just put it in the actual pixel resolution, square pixels, and it's, like, all stretched and distorted and squashed. So, yeah, the screen captures in here are, they're authentic.
Yeah, I mostly don't use modded hardware, which means that it's a really convoluted setup where they're going into an RF demodulator into the capture device, which depended on the time period of when I photographed any of these. Some of them I did in the kind of Framemeister, some of them I used a RetroTINK 5X.
And that's where my commitment to authenticity ends, when it interferes with my convenience. Like, some of that's just too much BS, so I'm totally happy to use modded systems or
clone
systems, FPGAs, it's fine.
I did have to use emulators for a few things, like some of these arcade games. Like, what am I going to do there?
Oh, yeah, arcade games.
Or unreleased, I have some photos of some stuff from RCA from their release stuff that only exists as binary files and emulators, so of course I grabbed screens of those.
You didn't want to build an RCA Studio 2 ROM flasher?
No, I didn't want to build the 1801 based Fredotronic hardware. No.
Yeah, that would have been man.
And then
fake gamer, I'll tell you what.
The MP1000 I have, actually the RF signal out of it was so bad I had to have Chris DeLee, who's done a lot of cool mod stuff for Jeremy, I had her do a composite mod for it, which apparently was a real journey for her, since the documentation for that mod is not very well.
Yeah, and just a shout out to Krista Lee here. She really seems to like these horrible journeys. I mean, like, I still am left in awe of the work she did to bring S-video capture to an Epoch cassette vision. Like, that was a months-long journey for her. Hundreds of hours of work, apparently. And, you know, in the end, like, I paid for that time, and I can't imagine ever paying that much for a video mod again, but just the fact that this was done and she figured it out is amazing. So, yeah, like, she's one of those people that is an unsung champion of game preservation and documentation.
You just cried out like the Lord there at the end, "It is finished."
Pretty much. So if you're ever looking for mod work done on a vintage console or restoration, Sound Retro Co. in Seattle, Krista Lee, she is the best.
Awesome.
Yeah, she does great work. So all the MP1000 photos in here, which I just turned to a page that happened to have one on there, like, that's thanks to her composite modding my system so I can actually get an image out of it without resorting to an emulator.
Kevin, I'm curious. You wanted to write a book. What are books about video games you enjoy reading?
So I really enjoyed... I've enjoyed Jeremy's stuff. I've got a few of his books. I enjoyed They Create Worlds by Alex Smith, which I've pulled from quite a few times in here because he was just very, like, in-depth, especially on early computer and arcade history. And actually, one of the books I like to go to is a book from 82 called The Winner's Book of Video Games by Craig Kuby. And the reason I single that one out is because Craig wrote this book about video games, and it wasn't just like a strategy guide on how to get high scores. It was that too, but he also did a lot of work talking about the games at the time and like the context that they existed in, and like what was popular and what used to be popular and what's like sort of a B-tier game. And he did a lot of work just presenting these in a way that really struck a chord with me when I was a kid and was checking out his book from the library. And, you know, that still stuck with me. Like, I ended up buying a used copy of his book just to, like, have it on my reference shelf.
Cause my public library had that book, and I read it over and over and over. Mm-hmm. My mom worked there, and she would bring it home for me, and I just read it so many times.
I was the only person who checked that book out past 1985. I remember that distinctly from the stamp page.
Yeah, this isn't about 1990 that I'm reading in, I figure. So, yeah.
Yep, this would have been around 91, 92. I remember excitedly telling my friends in elementary school about how Berserk had voice synthesis and none of them giving a crap about Berserk or voice synthesis. So, you know, gotta find your audience, folks.
So we've talked a lot about the book, but let's talk about the system itself and the games. Like, from your research, how did the 2600 even happen? That's kind of a big question, but I think it's time for you to walk us through it. Like, you know, obviously Atari was an arcade company. They made arcade games, and they'd hit it big. They were the first company to hit it big. And quickly, you know, everyone said, oh, let's make Pong games also. But, at what point did they say, these things we sell to, you know, play in bars, those could also be done in homes, on TVs?
Yeah, so, circling back a few years to about 1975, the company published their Home Pong standalone console that was also designed, I believe, by Cyan Engineering, same folks who would later work on the 2600. And this was post-Pong boom. This would have been the Pong bust from 74 when nobody cared about Pong anymore, and the only way to sort of get any juice out of that was to sell a home version. And a lot of companies were at the time because the technology had gotten to a point where you could have home game systems that were more advanced and still affordable than what you were getting off of the old Magnavox Odyssey from 72. Which also comes up a fair bit in this book. It was not a huge hit. It was like a modest success, depending on who you talk to. The Pong, on the other hand, did very well for the company, for Atari specifically. So they wanted to do a follow-up. They did do a couple other dedicated home game systems, Pong, Video Pinball, Stunt Cycle. But Steve Mayer, Ron Milner, they were sort of brainstorming. Like, okay, we have to figure out a new process for designing these systems. What if we design a single CPU-based hardware, and then we can just program our games for that and just sell each dedicated system using this setup. Wait, that's stupid. Why don't we just sell the hardware and then sell the games on some other medium? That'll be much more cost-effective. So that's what they ended up coming up with. They had to figure out what microprocessor they could use based on the price tags at the time and what deals Atari could get. At the time, video games were such small fry. None of the major microprocessor companies were giving sweetheart deals in anything. And they had a few couple... They had a few alternatives. None of them really fit exactly what they were looking for. By chance, they ran into Chuck Peddle from Moss Technologies. MOS Technologies. I don't... Call him Moss. Whatever.
No one knows. Yeah. It's lost to history.
Yeah, they met him at the at a computer fair, which, you know, I go into again further in this book in great detail. So, Steve Mayer, Ron Milner, they met up with Chuck Peddle, who was sort of their big guy at the time, selling the 6502 microprocessor, which they had just come out with, and they sort of went back and forth with him, figuring out how to get a cut-down version of that, 6507, which is what they used in the 2600 final design. It, you know, couldn't do everything a 6502 could do, but it did everything they needed it to do, and it, you know, helped keep this thing affordable, which was their big thrust for the design. And Steve Mayer and Ron Milner, they'd been working on some early sprite-based hardware for Atari's arcade games, like Sprint 2 was the one they pointed out to me. It was one of the first ones they were working on with that sort of design mentality. And they thought, okay, let's carry that over to this home system too. Which is why you have a system that has two player objects, two, you know, missile objects, and one ball object that gets reused for everything under the sun over the next, 14 years and beyond.
Yeah, it's really kind of amazing how much 2600 developers did with basically nothing.
Yeah.
Well, the Frankensteinian design. You know, the fact that they opted not to have a frame buffer because of expense, and Kevin, you can talk more about this, but what should have been a technological curse and did make programming the thing an absolute nightmare did, on the other hand, provide unprecedented flexibility for breaking the system. It's just so hackable that you can get away with a lot of things they never imagined. I mean, I'm sure you can share more on that.
Yeah, so they found that out very early on. So Steve Mayer explained to me that their design mentality was that, if we put everything that we would want in this thing to make it really effective with, like, a frame buffer, etc., it would cost too much. We can't do that. If we set it up so that it's like a, supply chain, a modern supply chain, where you're getting everything you need just in time for your stores. We all know how well that works in a pandemic, but for a video game system, it works pretty well, as it turns out. So this thing doesn't have a whole lot of RAM. It has no screen buffer to keep track of where objects are, like, colliding with each other. They had to build that into the hardware design because there's no way you can get that in software without the frame buffer and everything. But they made a machine that the programmers would have to develop for line by line as the electron beam is going down the cathode ray tube on the television, which is, incidentally, makes this nightmarish to run on most upscalers. But it's a very fascinating design that works really well for cathode ray tube televisions, good old CRT. And almost immediately, people were figuring out how to break this. So you look at Bob Whitehead's first couple games. He did Starship, which is a port of an extremely new arcade game by Atari, Starship 1. This is a first-person, like, space game, which really shouldn't be doable on the hardware, but he made it work. He had the flickering technique, which would show up a lot more on later games, where you just alternate on each frame which object you're showing, so that way you can have the illusion of having a lot more things on screen and it doesn't look too bad.
Which it kind of found a descendant on like the NES, mm-hmm. you know, with it had a famous limitation of 8 sprites per resolution, like per scan line.
Yep.
So when you had, you know, more than 8 sprites, the system had to kind of cycle through them, and programmers who really kind of understood what they were doing would say, oh, we have to give priority to this. And programmers who didn't understand would just be like, ah, just whatever happens, happens. So yep. that's why you get the screen flicker on, sprite flicker on NES. And, you know, when you're displaying stuff like this, it's recorded as, or displaying at 60 frames per second, but shows up on like YouTube at 30 frames per second or whatever, everything looks terrible. Like mm-hmm. The 2600 is a great example of how integral specific technologies, display technologies, were to the technology of the game systems. I mean, you know, there's famous things that you can't use on an LCD screen, like, you know, the Master System 3D glasses or light guns or Rob the Robot, because they're timed and keyed to CRT technology. But the 2600 as a whole just depends so heavily on the quirks of, you know, what was very well-established technology at that time. I mean, CRTs had been around for half a century.
Yeah. And you could see that, you know, they could use that phosphorus fade to their advantage. Things didn't disappear instantly on old TVs.
Mm-hmm. That's why flickering works.
Exactly.
Like, it doesn't work great, but it works.
But and on a CRT, it works even better. Like, you're just like, oh, I can... And it's stunning how innovative that was. Somebody thought that up. Like, we're used to video games from retro games flickering, but that was, you know, Bob Whitehead's like, this is solving a problem I have. Like, it's like 99 cents. Somebody thought that up. It's incredible that there was a first time and we can track it.
Mm-hmm. Or, you know, he did the blackjack game, which has multiple objects on one line. That shouldn't be possible, but he figured out, like, okay, if I do it this way, I can repeat the same object over and over again, and as long as, like, it doesn't have to change state individually, it'll work. Which, you know, blackjack doesn't. You just have to change whatever face is on the card. Larry Kaplan came up with the idea of, oh, I can just reuse the same object on multiple lines because the CPU has already moved on from that last one. And that's how he made Air-Sea Battle work. I can't imagine how that game would have been if you were only shooting at, like, one object at a time. It would not have been fun. But he figured it out.
I like what you said earlier about the 6502. I think so much of what makes the 2600 successful is that they chose the right processor. And the 6502 is legendary. It became legendary. At the time, it was cheap enough, and that's why a lot of people went for it. It was cheap and it was just fast enough. But the 6502 really could handle the kind of math 2600 games needed, and they could handle it speedily. The 2600 has big, ugly, chunky sprites, but they move super quick. You turn the accelerator on in Space War, one of the games in this book, and it forms a line across the screen eventually, the object's moving so fast, and the processor can keep up with it. The Apple II, the 2600, the Atari 8-bit line, the NES, the Commodore 64, and even by extension, the Apple II GS and later the SNES.
And the TurboGrafx.
And the TurboGrafx.
Don't forget about the TurboGrafx.
My favorite 6502 base machine.
It's a beast.
All from that family, first the 8-bit and then the last two. I kind of cheated with the SNES, that 16-bit version. But if they had gone with something else, that had gone with a different design philosophy. The nice thing about your book is you see what happens to people who did.
Yeah. Well, a couple of the other things we were looking at, they were looking at, what, the Intel 8080, if I remember off the top of my head, and the 6800, not the 68000, because that wasn't out yet, but the 6800. And those were used in the Odyssey 2 and the MP1000, respectively. And they worked, but they were, with the architecture those machines used, I don't think you could have done the same things that the architecture of the 2600 did.
No, both those had machines kind of chug.
Yeah, had you used it in the 2600, it would have been a mess.
Mm-hmm.
It's really fascinating the weird tricks people did so early on with this hardware. When they turn the pages of history, when these days have passed long ago, will they read of us with sadness? For the seeds that we left.
So one of the things that kind of comes out in this book is that all the games in 77 and 78 came out in two versions. There was the Atari game that probably everyone knows, and then there was something called Telegames, which was exactly the same game, but just repackaged. And I before this podcast, we had a book signing event, and then we had an audience Q&A session, and I realized that the Telegames versions of Atari releases were like basically Costco Kirkland repackaging of existing products. How did that even happen? Like, what was the deal?
So that is correct. A lot of the major department stores at this time had their own store brands of things that other companies had made. Like, I remember growing up, we had a Montgomery Ward's microwave. Did Ward's make it themselves? No. Someone else did, but it was Ward branded. And that's the part I remember, which is sort of the same idea here.
Yeah, I mean, you still have that with, you know, Walmart's Great Value and Target's various in-house brands.
Mm-hmm. And so, sort of the same idea here. Atari and Sears had a relationship going back to that home Pong system. Sears had sold it before anyone else. They had a timed exclusive on it, which my understanding was that was something Atari had to push back for, was that it was only timed, because Sears wanted to be the sole seller of this thing. And they needed Sears because they needed that that money, and they needed that that marketing muscle to get their machine on the shelf. But, you know, by the time the 2600 come along, Home Pong had been a big hit for both companies. They had a very lucrative relationship, so Sears wanted in on the ground floor for their programmable system as well. And they actually helped shepherd this through FCC approval, because at the time the FCC had to sign off on basically anything that would be emitting radio frequency signals, which is how all of the game systems at this time put out their, you know, their picture. I remember talking to Al Alcorn about this, who was one of the people I interviewed for this book, specifically about the 2600, which I don't think anyone has really done. They always want to talk about his work on Pong and the arcade division. But yeah, for 2600, he specifically said there were people at Sears who knew their way around these RF frequencies and FCC's requirements like the back of their hand, and they just helped push this thing through, and that's how the 78 or how the 2600. Sorry, now I'm getting the wrong numbers.
It's my fault. Sorry about that.
Yeah, that's how they got the 2600 out the door and out of the shelf so much more smoothly than literally every single other company in this book. And as to where that leads to the Telegames, well, that was sort of the price they paid for that that marketing muscle from Sears, which was at the time the biggest retailer in the United States. They wanted their own branding. This was how they got it, without having to have exclusive games yet. They did get a couple in, you know, subsequent years after the console had blown up and became a huge hit, but at this point they just had their own versions of these games. And
the interesting thing is that Sears packaging was actually more luxe than Atari's own packaging. Mm-hmm. Like the gatefold covers with the manual that tucks into the front, it's super nice, and actually Sega took cues from that with the SG-1000, the original large box versions of SG-1000 games had, you know, packaging very, very similar to that, and eventually they dropped that in favor of more compact, you know, tab opening type boxes. Yep. But at the start, that was kind of like, it just felt premium. Like, you open it, there's the manual, mm-hmm. there's the game. It just, you know, had a kind of a self-closing tab fastener. Really, really nicely made.
And they're really solidly built compared to, like, the cheapo boxes they started using in 78.
Oh, man. Like, yeah. I mean, yeah, when I think of, you know, 80s Atari packaging, late 80s especially, they just, it, like, you know, 7800, XEGS, it is, it's Lynx, all it that is just, oh, yeah. It's terrible. Like, there's no way to find a game that is just not, like, warped out of shape because they use such cheap cardboard and such cheap interior structure.
Yeah, it's barely a solid. It's like watching Star Trek and they find a founder and it suddenly just just morphs into some this gelatinous mess. I My first 2600 was a Sears Video Arcade. That's what my family had. They bought it at Sears, and a lot of my games, my early games, likewise, were purchased at Sears, so I had the telegames versions of several of the games in this book laying around the house.
It's funny, I had the telegames version of Starship, Outer Space, as a kid. I remember my aunt had that when she got rid of her all her Atari stuff. She gave it to us because I still played the thing. So it took me a long time to realize, oh, there's an Atari version of this called something else, because at the time, we were getting these things secondhand, like, I didn't know this. So I really wanted to make sure that Sears had representation in here. And yeah, that did lead, as you mentioned earlier, to us getting photos of both in every case.
But I think it's valuable, like, just to see how Atari and Sears presented the same game. Sometimes it's almost identical, you know, aside from the trade dress. Like, the Sears telegames boxes are a very consistent style, black with, you know, a colored title, and then there's kind of an inset frame in a rounded box that has artwork in it. And Atari has kind of their own style. But, like, sometimes the presentation, even the titles, are almost identical. Sometimes they're wildly different. And it must have been really confusing for people to go shopping in 1978 and be like, I've got to, you know, I want to buy a cool Atari game. I wonder which one I should get. Oh, there's these games I've never heard of at Sears. Like, how many people do you think bought the same game twice by mistake, assuming they would be different games, only to get them home and realize, I already own this one, but it was called, you know...
Yeah.
Whatever, you know, I don't know the titles, the alternate titles, but...
I'm going to guess it's a non-zero number. I know some of the ads that I saw at the time, which didn't make it into this book necessarily, would mention that, oh, it plays like, you know, such and such. Like, for example, Space Combat plays like Space War. It's the same game, but that's how they would, like, bill it. Yeah,
so I'm looking at Street Racer. The telegames version is called Speedway 2. So the game modes in Street Racer are Street Racer, Slalom, Dodge'em, Jet Shooter, Number Cruncher, Scoop Ball. On Speedway 2, the exact same modes are called Kamikaze, Road Race, Slalom, Scoop Ball. Okay, there's two that are the same. Number Cruncher, that's also the same, and Rollerball. So, like, 50% of these modes are presented under different names. So even that's, you know, like, you would look and maybe cross-reference and say, well, do I want this other racing game? It looks like it has some of the same content, but there's some unique content. I don't know. Like, were people that savvy about buying video games back then? There was certainly no internet at the time, but not even really a games press to speak of, to say, you know, like, to offer reviews, to offer shopping guidance.
Yeah.
You were just kind of, you know, tossed into the deep end and figure it out.
Yeah, at this point it was like, does your local newspaper write about video games? Like, do they have someone who does that? There was one paper in Ohio that did, and I referenced it several times in this. And then there was Video Magazine. They had their, what's it called? Arcade Alley, I think, column that Bill Kunkel and Arnie Katz wrote starting in 77? 78? I don't remember off the top of my head, but those were your options, and beyond that, you were sort of relying on the salespeople at these retailer shops, and they may or may not know a lot about this topic. That was something I came across several times in the retail industry press from this time frame. It's just like, how do I sell this stuff? I'm mad about it because I need to have, like, dedicated staff hanging around these video games that are not shilling for other objects.
I mean, selling a $30 video game versus selling a $300 refrigerator, where's the margins in that?
So, just growing pains there. Yeah. And eventually, after 79, I think basically almost all the Sears branded versions of the games have the exact same title as the Atari ones.
But even with, you know, games that have exact same titles, Blackjack, for example, Atari's has casino rules and private rules, and Atari Games has Las Vegas rules instead of casino rules, and home rules instead of private rules. Yep. If you stop and think, those are the same thing. But then also Atari says one player, two players, three players, which Atari Games doesn't mention except down at the bottom, not as a like as a feature, but as just, you know, how to play it.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I just feel like they're kind of working at odds with each other here.
I also love how some of the art on these is obviously, you know, you have the same game, Flag Capture and Capture, and it's obvious that two different artists got the same brief.
Yep.
Like, here's the art brief. And so in Capture for, you know, Telegames, there's kind of this, you know, conquistador guy standing on a beach, and there's like a little pirate ship out in the corner and a mountain and a guy climbing and they're holding flags. They're like, okay, so there's supposed to be like a pirate ship or a ship and a flag and a guy. But then you flip to, like, Flag Capture by Atari, and it's just dominated by this huge, lavishly painted, patched pirate face with this galleon, yep, like, going through the middle of it, a flying, like, there's flames coming out of the British flag, and with swords running out of one side.
What do you do when your game consists of nothing but a grid of boxes?
Yeah. Like,
literally, that was all Flag Capture was, so it was, you know, the sky's the limit in terms of your creative interpretation of this. What is this that you imagine it is?
And that's what I like, is that, like, you know, they hire two different people to draw these, like, based on the same specs, and they get one person is kind of like, well, I guess I'll make this. Another guy's like, I am going full-on Horatio Hornblower here. Captain Jack Sparrow, here I come. You know?
But still, it's a grid of boxes.
Yeah.
And you can understand why Nintendo went with the black box pixel art style to say, hey, this is actually what you're getting more or less when you buy this game. Mm-hmm. There are no, you know, painted conquistadors here to represent a black box. It is, you know, a little blue grid on the screen. It is Mario here. It is little Eskimo guy with a hammer.
A lot of honesty in marketing from Nintendo in that period, which I think culminates when they're just like, at first you have the black box games with this pixel art, and then you just have the Zelda gold cartridge with a little corner. It's like, with a hole showing, guess what's inside this box?
It's also gold.
It's a gold cartridge.
There's a cartridge in the box. That's what you're getting. It's gold, just like this gold box. But it was remarkably effective, and... Yeah, I mean,
sometimes you do get stuff like Brain Games, which is called Brain Games in both versions, and it has titles like Touch Me. And the question is, which version of this wizard do you want to play Touch Me with?
Yeah. I love how delightfully...
One of them looks really angry, so I don't know if I want him playing Touch Me with me.
I love how delightfully 70s a lot of the Sears art in particular looks.
The art
for math, like, is just gorgeous.
You put this on the side of a van, and people are like, yeah.
Yeah.
I'm definitely going to go toke up in there.
Mm-hmm.
Kevin, for you, like, all these very early games, I think that folks that go back and play ROM tag with these largely are going to skip most of the early 2600 ROMs based on the primitive nature of the graphics. Of this first batch in Volume 1, what games did you really, really enjoy the most?
So, my favorites, there's Basketball, which I think we alluded to a little earlier today, a couple of times. That game holds up really well, and I think that is borne out by the fact that it was still selling into the late 80s pretty handily. Breakout is a fantastic conversion of a game that's kind of timeless. Like, Breakout's just fun. I'm a big fan of Flag Capture, as we talked about. It's a game you either love or you hate. I love it. And Indy 500 holds up remarkably well if you can get two driving controllers. It can be a little tiring on your hand just holding down the accelerator button on those things, but
that's a problem with a lot of older racing games.
Exactly. Like,
you know, Rad Racer, you accelerate by pressing up, and that destroys your hand after a while.
It does. I don't know why it does, why it should, but it just doesn't feel good.
It's the worst.
But, like, Indy 500 has ice physics on one of the stages, which is really fun to go skating around.
Is that gaming's first ice level?
I think it is.
Wow.
That's cool. And for Indy 500, for folks that don't know, maybe you mentioned the driving controllers, which look like the pedal controllers, but...
they are completely different internally. Yeah. And this is the only game that used them at the time. There's a few Hex and Homebrew games that used them, you know, since then.
Yeah.
But as far as the original retail era of the system, that was it.
And, Kevin, do you play a lot of 2600 Homebrew?
Here and there.
Yeah.
Not as much as I used to, but I also have a toddler, so just not playing as much as usual as I could.
That's been one of the shocking things for me, and one of the joys of the Atari 2600 is that this is a system that, by the time I got it in 1982, was already several years old.
Mm-hmm.
I wasn't. I was three. But the system was. Here in 2023, people are still creating new 2600 games. And because of that weird architectural thing we talked about earlier, they're still finding new ways to hack the system to do stuff that nobody thought possible.
Mm-hmm.
And so... unlike a lot of systems that you kind of see top out, you know, you get used to like the 10-year later homebrews that blow things away, or, you know, late C64 homebrews of Ghosts and Goblins, where you're just like, how did they do that?
Yeah.
But the 2600, they still haven't hit the peak. The versions of Wizard of War and Super Cobra, or Galaga that came out recently, are just stunning.
Zookeeper.
Really
good. I brought that one to MAGFest last January and had it set up in the museum space for a little while, and folks just kept coming like, wow, this is a 2600 game, huh?
Yeah, and I can't play Doodlebug on my iPad anymore, but I can play it on my 2600.
Yeah.
You know, or Doodle Jump, pardon me. That there's people found a way to port that.
Is there a game called Doodlebug?
I don't know. There should probably be a Doodlebug.
Yeah, I touched on that a little bit in just my, like, intro to the console, like how the early homebrew stuff really kicked off, you know, while the body was still warm on this platform, because it went out of retail circulation at the end of 91, early 92, depending on the part of the world you were in. But the first homebrew developments for this thing were, like, 93, 94. Like, this thing was dead, but not forgotten for very long. And since then, it's just been sort of a snowball. Like, there's so many homebrew games for this thing, and I cannot keep track of all of them that keep getting
made. Yeah, I can't imagine trying to collect all the homebrew games. That just seems like a fool's errand.
Mm-hmm. And a lot of them are, like, really impressive. Like, they, you know, they're using what people have learned about the system over, you know, decades. Some of them are pulling out, like, illegal opcodes for the hardware that, you know, shouldn't work, but they do on the 2600. And then stuff like the Galaga port, they have on-cart hardware expansions, which only, I think, like, there's a couple of 2600 games that use extra RAM built in, but I think... Pitfall 2 is about the only one that has extra hardware.
Yeah, it's got the audio processor.
That or anything on the Star Path,
yeah.
But David Crane's Pitfall 2.
His DSP chip.
Yeah. And, but it is neat to see what they could do with an ARM processor and the cartridge without breaking... it's not like it's using it as a pass-through or anything. It's still limited by the TIA.
Mm-hmm.
They're just doing some neat new stuff with it.
And yeah, it's really taking cool. Some of the load off of the CPU.
So many acronyms being thrown around. What's a TIA? What's a DSP?
Let's ask the
TIA is the Television Interface Adapter, and that's the video chip, basically, for the 2600. And that's one of the custom chips in the thing. There's also the Riot, which is their input-output chip, and the CPU, the 6507. All right, you were asking about the DSP. That's
a digital signal processor?
I think so. I feel like it had a different acronym. I think David Crane decided to be cute and, like, give it his initials.
Yeah, like the DCP or something. I can't remember.
I think it's
the David Crane
like
processor?
It's something
that sounds
been a
right.
While. But it allows you to play the music in Pitfall 2 as mm-hmm. well as do a couple of the other visual tricks that he
does
like there.
Yeah, like the scrolling that the game uses.
Possible.
And, yeah.
It's not just music, but it's like dynamic music, right?
It is.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. That game is
that
so...
Madman.
That game's amazing.
That game is so forward-thinking, and if it had come out in any time other than 1984, it probably would have been a massive, like, influential hit.
It is the most un-David Crane, David Crane game ever. I love David Crane. He's a great dude.
What are you saying? That game is like the basis for A Boy and His Blob.
But it's not murderous. In Pitfall 2, when you die, you go back to these magical things called waypoints that he puts the game.
Yeah,
and you lose points, and then you're like, oh well, I'm never going to get the high score and get my pass.
Right, but compared to like Pitfall, A Boy and His Blob, Ghostbusters, it's just not nearly as like just vicious as those games are. Those are all very demanding games. Pitfall 2 is very merciful.
Is Ghostbusters demanding?
Can be. It depends on the version you're playing.
the NES version, but that wasn't David Crane. That was Bits Lab making some bad decisions.
But even C64 Ghostbusters, if you fool around, you're going to get stomped pretty quick. And that is...
Well, there's no time for fooling around.
Yeah.
You got to clean up the town.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. But yeah. 2600 Homebrew. Really interesting. I don't remember if I grabbed any screenshots. I think I did. Yep, there's screenshots in here of an Indy 500 hack from the early 2000s that added in a bunch of new maps. Just as an example, like, yeah, this is the sort of thing people were doing when they had access to this hardware through emulation. They started making their own versions of these games, and it just sort of escalated from there.
We were talking about David Crane. His Outlaw is in here, and Outlaw is not my favorite 2600 game, but the gunfight spinoff Homebrew that was made a few years ago is. It's just that game with everything improved and with Johnny Cash's Ring of Fire playing while you shoot at each other. Mm-hmm. Totally worth your time.
Yeah. It's hard to go back to Outlaw after playing some of the other versions of it, but at the time...
Oh, at the time, it was amazing. Oh, yeah.
Had a lot of fun with it.
Outlaw's incredible for when it came out.
Yeah, and your article on Outlaw is great. It really gets into the history of it, of gunfight, and how it intersects kind of with Space Invaders.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's a weird history for that.
Yeah, there's a lot more heritage for this game than you might expect.
And they got to include some information there about David Crane's design perspective and why he didn't really... he was okay with how Gunfight came, or Outlaw, rather, came out, but it wasn't how he wanted to really make games, and he sort of discusses how he doesn't care to have, like, a million variations of the game. He wants to just make a game with his ideal set of features and let the players figure it out from there.
Again, extremely forward-thinking.
Which is also how I feel like most people play 2600 games nowadays. I don't think a lot of them go delving into the different game types.
Yeah, all those dip switches on the console.
You don't want to play Invisible Space Invaders?
I can.
All combat modes should be set default to bouncy tanks, and then we'd be good.
Good old tank pong. My favorite was Skeet Shoot, which is from 81. It's a much more recent game, relatively speaking, but the default mode on that is awful, and if you go messing with the different game types on there, it gets kind of playable. So I described it the other day as a game that goes from what was the term I used?
From wretched to mediocre or something?
Something like that, wretched to mediocre is a good description. Like, just fascinating that was going to be the default game type on that one.
I think all games should switch with that slider now. Mm. Like, just wretched to mediocre. Like, you can just do that
instead of starting your game at, like, 7 out of 10, it's just wretched to mediocre.
Wretched to mediocre, yeah.
So in addition to, 20-ish?
Yep, 20.
2600 games that came out in 1977 through 78, you also touch on, the MP1000 games and the Odyssey games and the all those other systems. There's several other systems that you talk about. why was this system successful where the others failed? I mean, you talked about, you know, we talked about like the 6502 and how that was integral to the way the game's played, but sheer technology alone doesn't make that big a difference. I mean, it does, but we've seen Nintendo succeed with game systems that are technologically inferior to what's on the market, Game Boy or Switch even.
Yeah. So from my perspective, putting this together, it was sort of a confluence of a few things. Part of it was the price point made sense, so that aspect of the design was very smart.
Were the other systems more expensive?
A lot of them were. The Channel F cost more. I think eventually the 2600 undercut it pretty well, but I know the Bally Arcade cost like $300 at launch.
Versus the 2600.
Which was like 160.
Okay.
Somewhere in that range. Like a lot of people did sales at the time, so it sort of bounced around, but that was the general vicinity.
So Bally was like, no, go get a second job to afford the
Astrocade. And, you know, it was a system that had like nigh arcade quality graphics and gameplay, so, you know, you got what you paid for, but still. But it was like that was a factor. Corporate support was a big factor because Atari had Warner's backing. Warner had more money than God at the time, and they wanted to make this thing succeed. So they gave Atari all the resources they needed for it. And once the company in the 2600 had a little bit of a downturn in 78, they changed out the leadership. They didn't kill the whole thing. They just let them figure it out, and they did. And then you look at some of these other platforms, like the Channel F. That was put out by Fairchild, which had all sorts of issues with quality assurance and production problems. And on top of that, their other markets were imploding. So, you know, the system wasn't going to save them when they were hemorrhaging cash. APF, which made the MP1000, they were a small player. They never really had the resources. Magnavox. They didn't have the C-suite support that they needed for it for a few years there, and that sort of undercut it. So, like, all of these had different issues that sort of undermined them from becoming the same kind of hits the 2600 was. But at the same time, the 2600 hardware was such that you could do all sorts of weird stuff. You could do Space Invaders on this thing. Mm-hmm. You should not have been able to do Space Invaders on this hardware.
No, it really doesn't make sense.
But they made it work, and that was their breakout game, which it's not covered in this book, but...
I thought Breakout was their breakout game.
No, that was Breakaway. That was their Breakaway game.
Ah, there we go.
Yeah, Breakaway 4, it's on the cover.
So we can look forward to Space Invaders in Volume 3? That was 79 or 80?
That was 80. 80. I guess it depends on how I split up the years.
I have to imagine it's going to be 79 and 80. Yeah, I can see
it. I can see it. 81 would just be like
its own standalone thing. Volume.
Yeah. Ooh, Volume 2, you say?
I do.
Yeah.
I'm putting the pressure on now. Yeah. There has to be a second volume to this.
Yeah. I mean,
it says Volume 1 on the cover. Come on.
It's true. There has to at least be one more. But yeah, so you had that as a factor, just that hardware architecture working for them and not just against them. And there was the name branding, too. Like, Atari was well-known. Odyssey was better known, from what I've gleaned from early reporting. But, you know, Atari was, like, number two, and then you had everyone else. So they had that, too.
They had that Warner marketing machine to help out there and change that.
And they had Sears, which was a big help. And they had Sears to help them get through the FCC, which I have a whole chapter in here about how the FCC screwed over everybody else.
Which is incredible. Yeah, it says that's a really important part of this story. Just how I really love computer history. And, and a lot of computer history is defined by FCC regulations. I didn't realize just how much of an effect it had on the console industry around the same time.
Yeah, and shout out to Dale Geddes, who's a researcher up in Canada, who his big obsession is the FCC and the history of how that impacted video games and computers, because I was able to like run my draft chapter by him. It's like, okay, point out to me all the places that I need to rework, and he did that and put together something I'm very pleased with.
the lesson from consoles was follow the rules that we learned, and the lesson we learned from computers was ignore the rules and apologize later, and you win. That seems to be how dealing with the FCC played out.
Mm-hmm. And it was fascinating to me how the different ways these companies approached the FCC problem. Like Atari, they went through Sears. Sears got them everything they needed, RF-wise. You know, Fairchild, they had to cover that thing in just a metal tomb and redesign the hardware later. And RCA, they just ran the RF signal down the power signal too.
Yeah, that's amazing.
In some weird design that, you know, made sense to them, and it got them through, even though the people at the FCC thought it was just a failure waiting to happen.
Yep.
Just it's an interesting part of that story, and I'm really glad I was able to fit it in here, because it is so important and so overlooked on why Atari worked and nothing else really took off to the same degree. And like they had competition. Like the Channel F sold pretty closely to what Atari was selling these years that they overlap, and the Odyssey did too up until Space Invaders came out. But
I love that Radio Shack was so bad at shielding and so widespread that they just defied the FCC. They're just like, no, we just have thousands of stores, we're going to do this anyway, and you can sue us later. That they shipped a computer so badly shielded that programmers made it a feature in their games to use the electricity leakage to put sound effects through a radio that you set next to your Tandy. Like, you tuned it to a station, and it would play the sound effects through the radio.
Incredible. Like,
that was... And people would write for that ability.
So when's the Tandy book coming?
No, never. I just love the weirdness of electricity affecting how this stuff works. Sorry, I get excited about computers.
That's fun. No,
that's all good. We need to wind down now, but as a final thought on Atari Archive, Volume 1, 1977 through 1978, Kevin, what was your, I guess, biggest challenge putting together this book, and what are you proudest of?
There's a few challenges to this, depending on what time frame this all came together in. The first big challenge was finding out when these games came out, which I mentioned already. And for me, the other real challenge was getting this into a shape that was readable and, like, interesting to go through for me, I think. I had a separate editor that I paid while this was in a much earlier draft state. So I'll give a shout out to her, Meredith Dimmick. She went through this and picked out all the things that didn't make sense to her as someone who knew nothing about video games, and was like, hey, can you explain this better? Can you explain what the heck this means? And I think that made for a much stronger book, because it let me rethink how I was approaching some of these topics. So even if you don't know too much about, you know, how video games work under the hood, or about video games in the late 70s, I think this is pretty approachable, thanks to, you know, her help on that. Research-wise, tracking down some of these people was a massive pain. So it turns out the White Pages are my friends, as is the U.S. Postal Service. Some of these folks,
grand
I just
had, institutions all.
Yeah, some of these folks I just had to write letters to and hope that they responded, and a lot of them did, and they were able to give me some really good feedback. In some cases, I had to go out to archives to dig around old documents and old papers to figure stuff out. And
so just, you just switch out like a golden idol with an Atari Lynx to keep a giant bowl.
Oh, yeah, right.
Yeah, I like this.
It doesn't work, because the Atari Lynx is huge, but it's so lightweight, it's just empty air.
that was my failing, that's why.
That's why the ball comes and crushes you.
Yeah.
Did not make it out of that tomb.
So, Kevin, thanks for your time. Jared, thanks also for your time. Thanks for putting this book together. It's a great read. Again, this is Atari Archive Volume 1, 1977 through 1978 by Kevin Bunch. It is available now for purchase at limitedrungames.com. It's a press-run publication that Jared and I massaged into reality once we were given all the materials by Kevin. I'm really happy with the way it came out, and I really feel like this is an essential document of video game history, and I'm really proud to have taken a part in it. But also, it's super relevant to anyone listening to this podcast because it is a document of video game history that really provides more than just, like, here are some video games. It dives into the cultural and business history of the games in addition to, you know, just how they play and what a video game is. So it's, essential reading. I highly recommend it. And it will be available on Amazon.com later this year. So if you don't like hardcovers and prefer paperbacks, well, Amazon's got your back.
Good news.
Or paperback.
And, you know, special thanks to Jen Frank for putting together a very nice foreword for this.
Very, very heartfelt.
And very helpful also in some of the editing and, like, leaving comments and helping it come together. So if you liked her work, she was a factor in this one as well.
All right, so in conclusion, this has been a Retronauts episode talking about retro video games and game history and books thereabout. You can find Retronauts at Retronauts.com and on Patreon at Patreon.com/Retronauts. You can also find us on social media, as long as those platforms still exist, which much longer that's going to be. And, you know, we are Patreon funded. Most of our funding for hiring editors and co-hosts and that sort of thing comes from Patreon. So subscribe and keep the show alive so that we can keep talking about cool books. And of course, support Kevin in his endeavor. Kevin, where can people find you on the internet besides buying your book at Limited Run?
So I have a YouTube channel, youtube.com/AtariArchive, which is the video series that this book spun out of. I have a Patreon to support that, patreon.com/AtariArchive as well. I have the website that has, you know, assorted information and updates on occasion when I remember to, atariarchive.org. And finally, I'm on various social media platforms, depending on which one. It's Ubersaurus or Uberus at mastodon.social. That's one of them. So you can find me here and there. And on various Discords about game history.
All right. And Jared?
Oh, I don't know where to find me anymore. At Limited Run Games, doing my small part to help people publish their wonderful books about video games. And I'm not on Twitter anymore, so I don't know. I'm over at Instagram as PettyJared. If you want to see pictures of me staring at things, I don't know. That's a good place to do it.
I mean, I think it's important to mention the fact that PettyJared is not a comma, it is the word comma spelled out.
That is PettyComamaJared.
That could be confusing to people who can't see it visually.
You are correct. What about you, Jeremy?
Oh, I'm on the internet. You can find me around Jeremy Parrish. I do all kinds of stuff. It's weird. Anyway, thanks everyone for listening. Thanks again, Kevin, Jared, for talking about the origins of Atari 2600 and a book that expertly documents that process, that whole creation. I hope everyone will check out the book and look forward to more explorations of video game history and creations and publications and that sort of thing. That's what we do here, talk about old games and the people who made them and the people who document them. It is no